From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. On today's program, we're revisiting some of our favorite conversations. Dr. Rishi Manchanda reveals why he thinks our health is strongly influenced by where we eat, live, and play as part of our Road to Health series. And actor William Shatner discusses his new book, Spirit of the Horse, a celebration in fact and fable. But first, President Trump returned from his international trip to face a barrage of questions about connections between his aides and Russia. One of those people asking questions is Democratic Senator Al Franken of Minnesota. He says he's determined to find out the truth about the Russia controversy. Senator Franken is also an award-winning comedy writer, former radio talk show host, and author. His latest book is called Al Franken, Giant of the Senate. Senator Franken, good to have you on the program, sir.
Great to be here, Tavis.
Let me start with this. You were, as I just mentioned, an entertainer before you got into politics.
Yep.
It's not lost on me that Donald Trump was an entertainer of sorts before he got into politics. You have made the transition to being taken seriously. Can Donald Trump do that?
I don't know. You know, we took different approaches. I thought of that I had to sort of prove something because I had not served in public office before. And I made it a point to read as much as I could and learn about policy. And he seems to have taken almost the opposite approach, saying things like, no one knew that healthcare was complicated until I just realized it. So it's a completely different approach. He won. He's president. I mean, so I guess that was a success for him. Not so much for the country, right, as far as I can see, on so many different scores.
You may have just answered this, Senator, but if you were giving advice to Donald Trump about how to be taken seriously, again, because you made that leap, beyond reading and studying, as you've just intimated a moment ago, is there something else you might suggest to him? Because, again, neither of you had done politics before you got into it.
Well, there's so much in his approach. It's the people he surrounds himself with.
Mm-hmm.
I try to surround myself with people with experience who had some, who I knew their character, people had integrity. I don't know where to start with Donald Trump, frankly. I, you know, every once in a while he makes a correction, I guess, when they got rid of Michael Flynn and General McMaster came in, that was an improvement. It'd be nice if he traded up in a lot of areas in that way. But, you know, I've had a learning curve myself, and what I did was, you know, I became a workhorse and not a show horse. And that's how I learned the Senate, and I tried to become friends with members of the Republican Party and reach across party lines. I'm a progressive Democrat, and they know it. But there are places that you can find some kind of common ground, and try to do that. I don't think Donald Trump would listen to my advice if I had sound advice for him.
What was the steepest part of your learning curve?
Boy, that's a good question. I think part of it was just I had a career in which I learned how to be funny, and then I had to learn how not to be funny. and that was and so I had some parallel experiences. During the campaign, the other side, the Republicans, took everything I had ever written or said and put it through a $15 million machine called the Dehumorizer, which had some Israeli technology in it. And it took out every bit of irony or hyperbole and turned and context and made it into something that wasn't funny and then used it against me. And then once I got into office, and during the campaign, my team started putting me through a dehumorizer because I had to prove to the people of Minnesota that I was serious. So one of the hardest things I had to learn, and I write about this in the book,
mm-hmm.
there's a point in the help committee where We're having a hearing on the Employment Non-Discrimination Act, which says that you have to hire LGBT employees. You can't not hire them because they're LGBT, but you can't fire them. And in 30 states now in the country, you can get married, an LGBT couple. You can get married on a Saturday and get fired. Someone can get fired on a Monday because their employer, you're gay, you're out of here. And so we were having a hearing on that, and not one Republican showed up for the hearing. I'd never seen that. Not even the ranking member showed up. This was on the Health, Education, Labor, and Pension Committee. So I thought of saying, I think it's a shame that none of the gay members of the committee showed up. And I thought that would get the devil on my shoulder went, tell it. It's like, you'll get a huge laugh, because it was mainly LGBT activists in the hearing room as the audience, and the devil or the angel said, now, Al, you know why you came here, and that's not going to be helpful. And I was struggling, and then the angel and the devil each got an angel and a devil, and the angel's devil and the devil's angel talked to each other and did some great staff work. And I didn't tell the joke then, but I got to write a book.
Yeah,
the devil. To write a book.
You mentioned earlier in this conversation that Donald Trump is the president, and you're right about that. One could debate. One can debate, given what the Russians may or may not have done, whether he wanted fairly and squarely, another conversation for another time. But he is the president.
Yep.
And I'm thinking of a couple of books you've written prior to this one, one or two books that had the word liar in the title. And as I read this new book, Al Franken, Giant of the Senate, it seems to me that what troubles you most about Donald Trump is not necessarily his antics, not that he, in fact, won the election, but that he lies with impunity. Is that an overstatement?
Well, I have a trouble that he won.
Yeah.
I wish he weren't our president. But, yes, this is, I kind of, it's almost, if you think about it, about 15, 20 years ago, I wrote books about lying.
Yeah.
And Republicans lying or conservatives lying. And it's almost now adorable that you could make money exposing the people that politicians lie. And now he just lies. It's just day in, day out, and not paying a price for it. Or maybe he is beginning to pay a price. I don't know. But I have a global jihad on lies, and hope maybe this period will end, and we'll have a new era of neo-sticklerism, and we'll have some sticklers out there.
Mm.
But this is very troublesome, and him labeling all news fake news is a huge problem. And the fake news was what the Russians did during the election. They had 1,000 trolls in Russia putting out fake stories that were picked up on Facebook about Hillary. And this had an enormous effect on the election. And but now we're seeing his people, the Trump people in the Trump organization, who did not disclose meetings with Russians. We see that over and over again. They're not acting like people who have nothing to hide. So fortunately, we have a special prosecutor. And we have intelligence committees in the House and the Senate investigating this, and we will get to the truth on that. In the meantime, we have all kinds of effects from his being president, including obviously on health care, on civil rights, very, very troublesome things that is my job to address. Right now, these investigations will take some time, but right now we have some very serious things to address.
What do you make of the stories of late about his son-in-law, Jared Kushner? And isn't this the reason why so many of us were saying up front, you don't need to have your daughter and your son-in-law working in the White House?
Yeah, he seems to be one of the people who hasn't disclosed meetings that he had with Russians. This event that we heard about him trying to use Russian communications to have a channel to Putin, or basically to Putin, but using communications that our intelligence, that at least Kushner thought our intelligence couldn't hear. That's very troubling. We'll get to the bottom of this, but at some point, we may get to the question, what did the president know and when did his son-in-law tell him?
Yeah. You said three times, by my count, Senator, that we will get to the bottom of this. For those fellow citizens who don't believe that we ever will get to the bottom of this, that Washington just has a way of circling the wagons, that we may never know what really happened here. That Robert Mueller, with all due respect, doesn't have enough power as special prosecutor. How do you respond to those fellow citizens who think that we will never get to the real bottom of what happened here, truly?
Well, Bob Mueller is a man that I think everybody in Washington respects. You're right that the special prosecutor law, which was changed after the experience with Bill Clinton and weakened slightly, I believe still gives him enough power, and the limits on him would have to be exercised in a way that I think would cause incredible outrage throughout the country. But I don't want to get ahead of ourselves. We have to get to the bottom of things. I think we can. I think we have to make sure that we know what happens before jumping to any conclusions. That's the way we are supposed to do things in this country.
Yep. Al Franken's book is called Giant of the Senate, perennial.
Al Franken, Giant of the Senate, Tab.
What did I say? Oh,
you
I'm
said
sorry.
Giant of the Senate.
That's right. Al Franken.
It's Al
excuse me. Al Franken, Giant of the Senate.
Thank you.
Senator, good
Thank
to have you,
you
on. Thank you, sir. From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. We've all been taught that the best way to stay healthy is to eat well and stay active. Our next guest, Dr. Rishi Manchanda, says that our health is also affected by where we live, work, and play. He's part of a new generation of healthcare practitioners who see health as being more than a chemical equation that can be balanced with pills and procedures. He tells us more about this approach as part of our Road to Health series. Dr. Manchanda, good to have you on the program.
Thank you so much.
I've been reading about your work, and you refer to yourself as an upstreamist. What does that mean?
So the upstreamist term comes from a parable that I heard early in my career, and I adopted and made it my own. The parable is as follows. Three friends come to a river. It's a beautiful scene. Unfortunately, something really tragic happens. There are people in the water, children, adults, the elderly, all drowning. The three friends who come to the river jump right in. They save those. The first friend actually says, I'm a strong swimmer. I'm going to go to the waterfall's edge. I'm going to save those about to drown. And the rest of us now who've amassed along the banks of the river say, that makes sense. Rescue those about to drown. The second friend, meanwhile, says, let me swim a little further upstream. I'll coordinate some of the branches along the banks of the river, and I'll build a raft, and I'll usher more people to safety. Over some time, the success rate is marginal. Mm-hmm. You know, they're saving people. They're doing noble, heroic work. But something happens. They get a little fatigued, a little tired. They start saying things like, didn't someone teach you how to swim? People mm-hmm. in the water. And then they realize, wait, the third friend, where is she? And they look up and they see her and she's in the water. She's saving people, but she's swimming away from them. And they say, where are you going? There are people here to save. And she's saving people as she's going. She's doing the work. And she shouts back, I know. I'm going to find out who or what is throwing these people in the water. In the healthcare workforce, we have the downstream rescuers. Mm-hmm. We have the raft builders. Those are the primary care folks. We've always had the third friend, though, and I think what I call the upstreamist is that third friend, the healthcare practitioner whose job it is to routinely understand where people live, where they work, and as importantly, to have us figure out how to translate that knowledge into action so that we can prevent more people from falling in the water.
To take your parable a step further, if I may, who then is throwing these folk in the water, these people who are being subjected to unhealthy conditions where they live, where they work,
not access, no access to high quality foods. I mean, who's throwing these folks in the water?
You named it. Yeah. So the who or the what is actually instructive there, because the what speaks to what we in the public health and the social science world and the political science world have long known. These are the structural causes, the isms, right? These are historic, generational kind of forces that often define the nature of a neighborhood, and more importantly, what is not sometimes in a neighborhood, the access to the healthy food, the parks, et cetera. It's sometimes who. This goes to what some political scientists call not just the social determinants of health, but the political determinants of health. We know, I mean, now more than ever, that discussions in D.C. and state capitals around the allocation of resources, policy, those have meaningful impacts right now in healthcare, who has access to healthcare, who doesn't. These are the choices that ultimately define the nature of who falls in the water and who doesn't.
Let me be crass about this. I apologize in advance. So it seems to me with all three of those friends who are saving people in various ways, there's money to be made. But the real money to be made is being made by the folk who are throwing them in the water in the first place. Because as long as there are people who are suffering in this way, there's money to be made top down. You take my point here. What do we do about the people who are in this because there's money to be made? And if everybody were healthy, you included would be out of work.
There are there's this idyllic version that a vision, I should say, that motivates a lot of doctors who enter the workforce and are in it till in it still, to say, you know, give us the tools to and the technologies and the skills to learn how to take care of those who are downstream. But there are always doctors who say, I went into medicine to help people, and helping people isn't just mending them when they're about to fall over the waterfall, but figuring out how to prevent that in the first place. Look, I think to your point, it's a well-taken point. Who's profiting? I mean, it gets to this question of why do we have a system like this where we don't have enough upstreamists, maybe why we don't have enough people, why we have too many people in the water. It's financial. There's clearly incentives. And I think, unfortunately, it's not just one villain. I think there's a, we've all made choices.
It's a network.
It's a network, and it's happened over decades, you know, and in some ways it's happened on both sides of the aisle. It's beyond political kind of ideology. There has been this belief that healthcare itself is based on volume. Let's pay for volume and not value. So let's pay for every service you get and not for how healthy we ultimately make you. That's shifting now. That started happening about 10 years ago. The Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, actually helped to solidify some of the changes towards value that were happening. But the takeaway is this: as this is happening, as there, everybody has some responsibility in this, including physicians, including hospitals, including communities, and including policymakers. I know every day in the clinics in Los Angeles, in cities around the country, we can't afford to wait about to define who's responsible. We have to act because you have too many people coming into the clinics in South LA, where I used to work, in the VA system, where I took care of homeless veterans, in clinics up and down California with colleagues who continuously say, look, my patients are coming in because of headaches due to mold infestations in their home. Give me the tools and the teams that I need to be able to take care of that and not just prescribe pills. We need to figure out ways to act, and that's what the upstream approach to healthcare is all about.
Who cares enough about that reality to do anything about it? Because I mean, this is not a skill challenge, it's a will challenge. Do we have the will? We know we have the skill. But who cares enough about it to put their skill to good use to fix the problem?
You put your finger on it. I mean, just to underscore your point, in a survey done about 5 years ago of physicians nationwide, 90% of physicians said that their patients' social needs were as important as their medical problems. That's a, for some, an eye-opening figure. The problem is that only 1 in 5 of those physicians believe they had any ability to do something about it. They lack the confidence, the sense of efficacy. So you're right, it's a challenge not of knowledge, it's a challenge of will, and how to, really not why, but how. There's a couple of things that have happened, and this is part of the reason that folks like myself who've been talking about the upstream thing are now getting some opportunities like this. When you start having people who are paying for healthcare, whether it's individuals, whether it's self-insured employers who are aligned with to see the value out of what they're getting, and you see public payers like Medicare and Medicaid and others start saying, look, maybe we shouldn't keep on, we shouldn't continue to pay for every service, because what's happening is it's untenable. We're spending 2.5 times more than any other nation on healthcare, but we're getting less return on investment. We're less healthy than our peer nations. Something's not working. When you have those payers, as has been happening the past 5 years, start asking, give us value, not just volume. and forcing the healthcare system to come to terms with that, it's creating an opportunity where the value conversations are coming into play with the upstream lens, and that's the moment we're in right now. What remains to be seen, and I'm the first person to both evangelize and also be a skeptic, the question of the moment right now, the challenge we have is this urgency of now is to figure out how to capitalize on this opportunity to demonstrate that this upstream approach really works. And I think this is the first time, frankly, in a generation that we can do that.
Yeah. Why do you think that the timing is propitious now for doing that successfully?
I think there's a little bit of a tipping point emerging. It has been happening over the past 10 years. Those folks who are paying the bill are starting to ask for better value. I think it's because of an awakening culturally. I think patients, community members are starting to have a voice in the healthcare conversation, whereas before it was often doctor knows best. Mm-hmm. So I think there's a cultural democratic kind of nature mm-hmm. that is inviting more people to have a voice. I think it's also something about this moment that we're in historically, right? Where we're realizing that we're all in this together. If you have a part of our economy that's taking up more than 20 cents out of every dollar that we spend, and that's robbing other opportunities, you know, to invest in education, to invest in public health, to invest in transportation, to invest in girding up the neighborhoods of America, there's this set of questions. And I think what we saw with the election, for instance, is an awakening of the pain that's out there in many different communities that was previously blind. Mm-hmm. Some people were blind to it and in other communities and vice versa. There was a lot of, I think, eye-opening experiences, mm-hmm. painful as they were, during the election process. And I think now people are saying, all right, clearly something's broken. Let's fix it.
Let me return one last time in this conversation to your analogy of those three friends in the water. I don't want to get in too much trouble with black folk and their lack of buoyancy when it comes to swimming. You'll take the joke. But it seems to me that the disproportionate number of folk who are drowning in that water are black and brown. For whatever reasons, they're unable to swim, and they're black and brown. So while we hypothesize about this and talk about how to capitalize this and how to how to address this, mm-hmm. you got folk in the water who are still dying, disproportionately people of color. What do we do about that? Amen. While we're trying to fix this?
Yeah, you're exactly right. There's a lot of folks in the payer side saying we care about value, and one of the important things to your point is that we have to ground this conversation in values. And that includes justice, that includes fairness, equity. There's no doubt that as we try to, as payers and healthcare providers and public health folks try to capitalize on this opportunity at this moment, that we have to be mindful of the lopsided nature of health and illness in America. And the reason for those disparities is in large part because of those policies that have long, the racism, structural racism especially, that has long been codified in our nation's policies. That has a direct influence on the distribution of disparities in black and brown communities. What I think is important right now is to figure out ways to be able to have the conversation about what we so need in this country, which is more upstream investments. We are, compared to all of our peer nations, we're the only country that has a lopsided ratio of spending. We spend more on healthcare than we do on social services. You go to other peer nations, mm-hmm. this is the opposite. It's called the American healthcare paradox. Mm-hmm. And there's no surprise then to those in the know who are in communities and not just professionals. That's why we have this, a lot of these disparities. We're investing in the wrong places, we're not investing in communities, and we're certainly not investing in communities that have historically been marginalized mm-hmm. and continue to be marginalized because of these choices. Part of what my role is as a doctor is to bear witness mm-hmm. and then to figure out how to invite others into this conversation about the changes we have to make to be value-based and values-driven. And it has to be based in a framework of equity and justice.
Indeed it does. Rishi, good to have you on.
Thank you.
From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. William Shatner is an award-winning actor, producer, recording artist, and author. He's best known, of course, for his iconic role as Captain Kirk in Star Trek, but he's also had a string of other starring roles on TV, including his role as the Priceline Pitchman. His latest book is called Spirit of the Horse, a celebration of fact and fable. Mr. Shatner, good to have you on the program.
you've been at this for a while now. What do you make of the fact, and I'm not going to give all you put your business out, but I know you came from another taping to do this. So you're still busy, you're still working, you're still out there.
In fact, I started very early in the day to do publicity. My book has come out, The Spirit of the Horse has come out, and as you well know, and I'm sure some of your audience knows, then the author goes out and publicizes, hey, I got a book, thousands of books are being printed, this one you should read. Actually, this one you should read because it's got 5 stars. I buy a lot of books on my phone. I travel a lot, and I'm reading all the time. So I see a book with 3 stars. That's pretty good. 3.5, yeah. 4. Wow, 4.5 stars. I'm buying that book.
Yeah.
This is 5 stars. Mm-hmm. I'll buy this book like now. In fact, I bought 2 copies just because it had 5 stars.
that means either people love William Shatner or they love horses. Which is it?
Well, it's probably a combination of both.
Yeah.
And the... What I was going to go to was that in order to ride at the level that I do ride, I ride competitively in 3 disciplines. Mm-hmm. Reiners, which are horses that do a pattern based on cowboy moves so that the horse might gallop into the stadium and 40 miles an hour slide to a stop, then do a roll back, go to the other end, slide to a stop, come to the middle, slide, back up, do 4 turns to the right, 4 turns to the left. Then fast circle, slow circle, change leads, fast circle, slow circle, change lead, come to a stop. That's one pattern. Now you practice and practice and practice. So you got to be in good shape.
Yeah.
So I love this. I love that competition. I'd love to get on these horses who are Olympic athletes trained by Danny Girardi, a genius at training. And I love to fulfill the promise, the potential of the horse, and not get in it. Its way, his or her way. I got to be physically adept at that. I got to have stamina. I've got to have balance. In order to do that, I've got to work out. I've got to keep trim. I've got to be careful. And that may very well be a reason that I'm as healthy as I am.
So the horses have kept you young?
Yes.
Yeah. The description of that activity alone could wear somebody out. Much less actually sitting on the horse while all that's going on. At your age, why still do that? And do you not fear or get concerned?
Well, I've broken legs 3 times. After 30 years of hard riding in any profession, your body wears out. My back is really, is gnarly.
Yeah.
And they say, maybe you shouldn't ride. I've got to ride.
Right.
I've got to act. I've got to be a performer.
Yeah.
I've got to ride a horse. I've got to be in love. I've got to work. Mm-hmm. I've got to play.
Yeah.
I've got to love dogs and horses and children. And I've got to feel that I've done something good, which brings me to horses and a horse show. Mm-hmm. Here in Los Angeles.
You do it every year.
Every year for 30 years. Mm-hmm. I've raised quite a nice sum of money every year. Not the millions of dollars that these big campaigns do. Small charity, but several $100,000 over a 30-year period amounts to many millions of dollars that go to children and now late to veterans as well whose ills are similar. In socially and physically and emotionally, the horses, this riding therapeutic programs aid all those things, all those ills. So now I find myself with children, autistic children who talk to me. And I'm able to say, look at you, you're talking to me in front of thousands of people. Mm-hmm. You're talking to me, and you're telling me you're autistic. Look at you, you're communicating. And the kid's going, yeah, I am, I'm doing. Doing something good is also part of my life force.
Who knew that horses could heal that way?
Who knew?
Yeah, yeah.
I'll tell you who knew. Eons of people knew. The horse has been domesticated 10,000 years. The magic that humans have to horses has been forever. In Arabia, where the great horses essentially started, they take them into their tents. They treat them as family. Those Arabian horses are like children to them. The Arabian horse with that beautiful face and that eye and that gorgeous body and trained and bred for endurance across the sand. So they move with grace and great endurance, and their look makes them even more lovable. They're bred for that. And go from there to all the other different types of horses. War horses that knights of yore would get on with 500 pounds of armor, and this horse now is bred stocky. Now that knights don't get on with armor, they use them as draft horses. But draft horses were the war horses 500 years ago.
You keep this up. You keep this up, I'm going to buy a horse tomorrow. You can talk me into buying a horse tomorrow. You keep
buy a horse and run alongside it.
Yeah, you had a litany of things that that you had to do. I have to do this, and I have to do this, and I have to do this. And I stayed with you for the entire list. The one I want to come back to is your acting. Why, for these 70 years, have you had to act?
Well, I started when I was about 6 years old. And I've never done anything else. This is what I do. But what I've discovered, and it's part of this book, as I evolved to understanding the spiritual, mystical nature of horses with human beings, so I too have increased my awareness of the unity of everything. All life is unified. The DNA of a tree is not that dissimilar to our DNA. You can see the relationship of plants to humans. All life is one. As that knowledge, as I have acquired that essentially spirituality, mm-hmm. I've become not only a better human being, but a better actor, and incidentally, a better horseman. All because I'm becoming more and more aware of what horses teach you. Horses are a prey animal. Things are lurking in the bushes to eat a horse. So the horse can't think about yesterday when the tiger came, or tomorrow when the wolves will come. They've got to think of what's happening here in the now. They have to stay in the now. And that's what horses teach us. One of the lessons mm-hmm. is to stay in the now of something we can do.
What have you tried to or hoped to communicate to us through your acting all these years? You've played so many different characters, of course. What have you tried? What's it been all about for you in relationship to us?
I don't think of it in those terms. What occurs to me as you ask me the question is that in a serious role that with some import, mm-hmm. there's always humor. Mm-hmm. And in a comedy, there's always importance. There's always so if you can balance being funny with being serious, and you've got these two things going, or vice versa, you've got a more rounded character, because that's generally what human beings are anyway.
Well, and what was Captain Kirk, a serious role?
Captain Kirk was serious with a sense of humor. Mm-hmm. Which is different than the actor trying to be funny.
Yeah. And the difference is?
Consciousness. Yeah. You're unconscious as Captain, as the character. You're conscious as, oh, look, I'm going to tell a joke now.
Yeah. What do you make, and I'm sure you've been asked this before, but not by me, so I'm going to ask it anyway. What do you make of the impact that role, you're playing that role, has had in a series that lasted a few seasons?
What's your question?
It's mind-boggling to me.
Yeah, it is mind-boggling. Three seasons and gone.
Yeah.
And then 50 years later, we're
exactly.
talking about it.
Yeah.
So what's your question?
My question is, what do you make of the impact that role
Well, it's extraordinary. Here, 50 years later, we're saying, I mean, it's embarrassing. Well, you know, I make a personal appearance and mother, and I've done some children's shows. So some of the kids, 3- and 4- and 5-year-old kids, know me from the voice of what the children's show was. So the grandmother says, come on, Charlie, I'm going to show you. And this is Captain Kirk. And the kids seen a couple of television that are 50 years old. They're like, where's Captain Kirk? My way's Captain Kirk. There. Well, that's not Captain, you know. Yes, I. That's me, you little monster.
But it does show. It does show, though, the impact that your work has had, because you are known by different generations from different characters, including even the Priceline guy. I mean, but different generations know you for different roles.
I've had an interesting series occur every decade, really. Even some that have gone by somewhat unnoticed. There was a Rescue 911 that lasted 5 years, and it was one of the, perhaps the original reality show that brought you what these EMTs were doing, and we consciously had an 80% success rate, and it's not that in real life, but it made for a more positive show. That was something I was very happy to be a part of, Rescue 911, and then there was an earlier one called For the People, early in my career, out of New York, that was really very good, but it was up against a popular show and was 13 and out. But so there's been a series, like every several years, there's a something rather nice happened.
You started out as a Shakespearean actor back in the day. Is this what you thought, hoped, dreamt of? Or put another way, I assume, I could be wrong, you tell me, I assume you're okay with us forever knowing you as Captain Kirk versus your Shakespearean training.
Right. It doesn't matter to me.
Doesn't matter?
No. Yeah. The Captain Kirk thing, I'm here with you. You're a wonder, you've got a great mind, and you examine people, and you talk, and you're serious, and you're funny, and it's great. It's a pleasure to be with you. It's a privilege to be with you. I'm here because of Captain Kirk. Originally, which started the whole thing. So I'm happy with the character and references to it. I don't mind that. As for Shakespeare, I learned poetry, iambic pentameter, the way the usage of words, the way we balance on words, the way you color words, the way you phrase a Shakespeare part so that these long speeches are actually broken down into moments in it. And that's been my training, and that's what I bring to the role. So Shakespeare and Captain Kirk are linked. That's the way I think of the whole thing as, you know, it's one larger story in which I think I've evolved, and I've become a better actor every time I've performed. I get better. I keep saying to myself, oh, that's how you do it. I didn't realize that's how you did it. So I finished this movie recently, Senior Moments, and I did a really good job. But there were times I was like, of course, I'm like a solo, I'm like playing on a solo machine there. I've evolved. I've gotten.
And have you gotten good yet?
I'm getting good.
Yeah.
I mean that. I mean that sincerely. Okay. I'm getting good. Yeah.
what do you make of the fact, as you've been getting gooder over the years, what do you make of the fact that you have been so, I don't know if there's anybody, I was trying to think of a short list of people I could compare this to, who have been caricatured and copied, and, I mean, the way you speak, your style, has been imitated by everybody, your mannerisms. Do you get a kick out of that? Are you annoyed by that? Well, is it funny to you?
No. It's so strange. I remember saying to somebody, does Jimmy Stewart know he goes, does he know he does that? You know, which is not dissimilar to Edward G. Robinson, So he's going, and he's going, Do they know they do that? If you were to ask, I worked with Eddie. Yeah. I worked with Mr. Robinson years ago, and I wish I had the chutzpah to have said, you know, Mr. Robinson, you know you go, nyah, nyah, well, I'm nyah. Yeah. So I don't know. He would say, "What are you talking about? Get out of my way."
Yeah.
And so I don't know what they're doing. When they say, "I do," I don't do that. Have I done that? No. Am I doing that?
No.
You know what? No, you don't. You don't do that. But you do. We all have a way of speaking.
Well, of course.
And, and what's funny about this is, I would never. Now I'm going into.
What's funny about this is? Yeah, what's funny about this is? That's you.
See, I'm going into my trade secrets now. So one of the things I do when I talk to guests is to sit here, and I want to get into your spirit.
Yeah.
I want to get into your flow. And good. So if you're loud and crazy like Robin Williams was,
yeah,
there's a chance I'm going to be loud and crazy with you because I want to match your energy.
Right.
But I always take my time to figure out the pace at which the guest speaks.
Are you consciously figuring that out?
I'm consciously figuring that out because I know that everybody speaks at a different pace. And you have this sort of halting way. You have this these pauses.
Yeah, but I'm thinking of what the hell I'm saying. Imagine rambling on and not giving yourself some thought about what the correct word did.
It works for you. I'm just telling you that you do have a unique way of spacing.
But we all do that. Yeah. You know what I mean?
I'm stopping this, man. You can't clown me on my own show like this, man. I guess you can because you are William Shatner. When will, if ever, you know that it's time to stop doing what you have done and do so well?
He's dead. He's dead, Jim. I guess he'll stop now.
Is that the answer? You're not going to stop until you... They got to carry you
what
out.
What am I going
to
do?
Yeah.
I'm going to sit there and say, God, I was on the Tavis Smiley show once. You know. Well, I wonder if he'd have me back.
Yeah.
I'm good. I've gotten good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You're just going to keep doing it until they...
Until they find out I'm not.
Yeah. your albums. I'm just looking back on all... I got you here just reflecting on all these things you have done. The choice to do that was because?
Well, I was offered the opportunity in the beginning years ago. Yeah. I think I was shooting Star Trek. They said, would you like to make an album? Oh, okay, I'll make an album. So I chose pieces of poetry, and I'd come off the stage at that point, and I was still imbued with the idea of poetry and music, and I had somebody write background music. And there were a couple of the items were pretty good. I did it To Be or Not to Be, and I thought it was pretty good. Music segued in and out. And the concept of that album was that the great pieces of literature, write music behind it, segue into a piece of literature of the time, which was a song, the lyric. So you'd have music under literature and the lyric literature with a song. Mm-hmm. So there was and the song might have been a comparative. It might have been an opposite philosophy. I may climb to no great heights, but I will climb alone. It's a Cyrano de Bergerac. Segues into a drug song where the guy can't climb alone. That sort of thing. To Be or Not to Be, shall I live or shall I not live, segues into It Was a Very Good Year. Now, it was an interesting concept. Some of it didn't work, some of it did work, but the story is I was doing publicity on Johnny Carson's show, and so I was going to do the drug song, which was Cyrano segueing way into Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds, and then Freddy de Cordova came running up and said, "That's 6 minutes long. You got 3 minutes. What do you want to do? The speech or the song?" Well, I might as well do the song. So I'm doing the song with no explanation. I'm doing a drug song. And I see Johnny Carson looking, going, "What the?" So everybody laughed, and it was the end of the album. So it was years later before I was asked to do another album.
One, yeah.
But then I did an album with Ben Folds, which got great critical success.
Yeah.
Has Been, it's called.
Yeah. Before I let you go, because you raised this, I want to circle back to this, especially since you mentioned Johnny Carson and Freddie de Cordova. How do you process that? How do you...
Death?
Yeah. How do you process
it? Scares
it. Does it?
Oh, yeah. You?
It does.
Is it you?
It does. It does scare me. Except that, for some reason, I got a lot more comfortable with it at 50
I'm 52 now. I got a lot more comfortable at 50, at 40. At 40, strangely, I was scared to death. I was just afraid that I wasn't going to live long enough to get some things done that I really wanted to accomplish. And so and I still got a lot more to do. But at 50, I got a lot more comfortable with it. But I'm at the age now where I got a lot of older friends. And I see my friends now starting to pass. I'm not at your age yet, but I'm having an issue myself processing losing so many older friends right about now. So I'm just curious how you're dealing with that.
See, I know consciously that when we die, our bodies decay and we enter the flow of energy, which is the universe. And in many years to come, it reforms and forms other material. I know that consciously. That's what I believe. I don't believe in heaven or hell, and I don't believe there's retribution for ills that you've done on earth. I think you just die. So you're alone. Loneliness has been my enemy for many years. As a kid, growing up, when I went off to do regional theater work, as I started a career, I was always lonely, deathly lonely. Loneliness was death, akin to what I'm thinking about death. So when I die, I'll be alone. And I've often talked about, and I do a one-man show, mm-hmm. and in that one-man show, I ask the audience, what do you think that final moment is going to be like? You're alive, you're conscious. Am I dying? I'm dying. And here's death, and you're coming, you say, oh my God, I think I'm going to die. I'm dying. Now what happens? That's the scary part.
Wow. The book is called Spirit of the Horse, A Celebration in Fact and Fable. There's a lot to marinate on, given what you've just offered. I'm honored to have you on this program, sir.
Please.
Thank you, my friend.
Thank you.
You can catch me weeknights on my television show on PBS. For more info on what I'm doing or to hear this show, past shows, or the Tavis Smiley Show podcast, visit TavisSmileyRadio.com. The Tavis Smiley Show is a news and opinion program produced and recorded in Los Angeles by SRP Productions in partnership with Public Radio International. Christabel Nsi Abuadi is our executive producer. I'm Tavis Smiley. This is PRI. Keep the faith.